The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Monday, October 9th, 2017. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Monday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, the Manhattan DA, Cy Vance Jr., how many cases of powerful people facilitating campaign contributions to his campaigns and getting away with things are we going to uncover? First, it was two of the Trump kiddies, Ivanka and Donald Jr. Now, movie producer, monster, commonly known monster, Harvey Weinstein. New reporting in the International Business Times. We're going to be talking with investigative reporter Jay Cassano about both of those cases, as well as, of course, the Weinstein stories that he, along with others, the International Business Times broke. The Trump administration is planning on scrapping an Obama administration climate and pollution rule with no replacement in sight. No surprise there. And also no surprise, Senator Bob Corker, in a Twitter dispute with Donald Trump, says what all of us are thinking. This idiot could get us into World War III. And Stephen Miller, with the look of an aspiring school shooter and the charm of a Nazi camp guard and the ideology of a Gamergate Grand Theft Auto player racist, is still a key policymaker in the White House. New reporting on him and just how, just relentlessly, he is a horrible, disgusting human being.
He's so much that guy from high school.
It's excessive how much he is that guy from high school. We're going to be talking about that. The president keeps trashing the Iran deal, one of the greatest steps to global stability in the modern period, and his own mad dog doesn't agree with him. We'll get to that and much more, including Turkey all of a sudden saying, yeah, you're not going to get a visa to vacation here anymore. All that and much more on today's Majority Report.
Trump wasn't nice enough to the security personnel?
Apparently. And I'm sure there's all sorts of other sort of paranoia and things that relate to what the Erdogan regime is doing. And I think we can switch to that regime language. Now, Donald Trump was, of course, in Puerto Rico last week. We played it, everything from his sort of mind-blowingly offensive and stupid statements to the people of Puerto Rico.
By the way, do you know how long he was in Puerto Rico where that highlight reel came from?
I'm going to guess no more than 2 hours.
Four.
Okay. All right. Always give the least charitable interpretation. Okay, four. So he was there, and then, of course, we played the, and everybody ran with the toilet, the paper towel basketball shooting reel because it was just demented and bizarre and weird and off-key and kind of hilarious, which would be, I guess, a good expression of this whole administration. As Adam Johnson said, the only thing they're competent at is racism. And here is Donald Trump talking with Twitter's most active and most unfunny user, Mike Huckabee, on his new TV show about his interpretation of throwing paper towels at people recovering from a major catastrophe, which he's just been belittling for most of his time since it happened over Twitter and on the ground, and then throwing paper towels at them like he's in a shooting contest. Here he is explaining what the fake news missed about it.
So we did a great job, and we weren't treated fairly by the media because we really did a good job. I mean, one example, they had these beautiful soft towels, very good towels. And I came in, and there was a crowd of a lot of people, and they were screaming, and they were loving everything. And we were—I was having fun. They were having fun. They said, "Throw them to me, Mr. President." And so I'm doing some of the, So the next day they said, oh, it was so disrespectful to the people. It was just a made up thing. And also when they had, when I walked in, the cheering was incredible.
You were a rock star. I saw the video of it.
It was crazy. The cheering was, it was deafening. They turned down the sound so that you just heard the announcers, Donald Trump. And I mean, look, the media is fake. In the meantime, I'm here. It's sort of amazing. So I'm here. And I sometimes ask myself, how did I ever get here with the horrible, unfair publicity? And I don't mind. Look, if it's fair, if I do something wrong, treat me badly. But when we're doing good, it should be fair. The media is really the word, I think one of the greatest of all terms I've come up with is fake. I guess other people have used it perhaps over the years, but I've never noticed it. And it's a shame. And they really hurt the country because they take away the spirit of the country. We're doing so well in so many ways.
I would say yes, perhaps other people have used the word fake over the years. Yeah, the media was totally unfair to him. They ran uninterrupted campaign rallies throughout the entirety of the fucking primary season, gave him an unending amount of free coverage to spew racism, entertainingly dunk on his opponents, and just sort of do freewheeling conspiracy theories and love his crowds. But now he's stressed out of his mind. He hates his job. And, of course, the press is being incredibly unfair. There is an olive branch he offers there, which is when he's doing badly, treat him badly. To which I say, okay, I'll continue to treat you badly. You racist, disgusting, trust fund baby, daddy's boy, increasingly unstable buffoon. We will be right back with Jay Cassano on the Majority Report.
Pressures of your life and it tough. Now stay down, mama, time pick it up. Now bother with the down, full style, strictly up, full vibes. Now pick it up when the bills, them, the rent and the mortgage due. Yeah. When me chalice, when your best friends are gone and it's only you. Yeah. Light up a split, turn up the music. Skanking sweet, everybody wanna. That brings everything together. So make we sing together. And who said life no order? And every man got this struggle. I beg you to help me, Lord. And let me overcome my troubles. Skanking sweet. Everybody wanna feel like free. Forget your troubles and the rapid.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks in the chair. Joining us now is Jay Cassano. He's an investigative reporter for the International Business Times. Jay, how you doing?
Good. Good to be back.
It's a pleasure to have you back. And you guys have been doing some very interesting reporting on a Manhattan DA that is starting to resemble something out of like a Batman movie or something. Before we get, you have two new pieces that you guys reported, you along with David Sirota and Josh Keefe. But before we get to that, you know, this attention that has been paid to Cy Vance, a junior in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, goes back to a story which kind of shockingly, I think, has not gotten that much attention. I mean, there's a lot of maybe, and I think part of it might be because everybody's sort of exhausted from Trump corruption stories. There's no surprise that his family would be corrupt. But the story of essentially how it seems as if, you know, sort of almost just kind of textbook, simple, paint-by-the-numbers corruption with Don Jr. and Ivanka and Cy Vance is sort of shocking. Maybe not shocking for Trump's, but it's shocking for Vance until your additional reporting came out. But before we get to that, can you kind of run through the Don Jr. and Ivanka corruption story versed and the Manhattan District Attorney?
Yeah, it was a real bombshell report that that Jesse Eisinger and the joint team at ProPublica and WNYC came out with last week. You know, they basically found that there was an aborted criminal investigation into Don Jr. and Ivanka Trump's real estate business, and they were lying about how well units were selling in their Trump Soho development. So, you know, kind of standard Trump family business practice, lie about how well your business is doing in order to get more business, always maintain right. that image, right?
Right.
And, you know, while that investigation was ongoing, Donald Trump Sr. Was apparently getting kind of agitated that that investigation wasn't closed. So he sent his personal lawyer, Mark Kasowitz, on the case. And Kasowitz had given $25,000 to Vance's campaign earlier in the year. Kasowitz met with DA Vance, and the case was dropped. Now, it's true that the DA's office returned the $25,000 contribution that Kasowitz made once he was involved in the case, citing, you know, their standard sort of conflict of interest policy on campaign contributions. But after the investigation was closed, Kasowitz came back with an even bigger donation for Vance and fundraised a little extra on top, bringing the total amount of cash he delivered to Vance to $50,000.
So, okay. And, yeah. So then, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. They basically, they skirted their own process, and he, you know, he raised even more money. And the really striking thing about their story was that, when Kasowitz had that meeting with Vance, no one from the district attorney's office's investigative team that was actually working on the Don Jr. and Ivanka case was in the room.
Right.
It was just a meeting between Kasowitz, Vance, and a couple of his higher ups.
And then, you know, and recently, and now Vance has given it back several years later.
Yes. Now, once it was brought to attention to the public's eye, you know, he said, oh, I'll give it back, you know, to sort of maintain that image. But
which, of course, looks even worse. I mean, you know.
Right.
It's like, oh, well, now that this is this sort of unbelievable case on the public record, let me give it back. Now, before we get to the new things that you guys have broke, I mean, can you tell us a little bit more, like kind of some of the basics of Cy Vance? You know, he's not been particularly high profile. He's a Democrat. His dad was, I believe, Secretary of State in the Carter administration. He's, you know, kind of familiar sort of blue blood, inherited political power kind of figure. But I had not heard these sort of, I never, you know, there was nothing kind of progressive or interesting about Cy Vance, but there also was not a sort of reputation of corruption around him either.
Yeah, I think he was kind of your stock, you know, family politician, you know, bred for the office, district attorney. You know, he, a couple of things he's been known for is he's been a proponent of gun control and opposed to digital encryption technology. But other than that, he hasn't really taken any stands that have been strongly publicized, as far as I know. You know, it's like you said, he's just kind of this the standard stock figure.
So now, in and all this is happening, and it, there was this bombshell. I mean, it was kind of odd. I mean, can it really be a bombshell? If it, it seemed like knowledge of Harvey Weinstein as every type of monster imaginable. I mean, there's stories about him and rumors and everything else of him as someone who was, you know, harassed and abused women sexually and otherwise. There were stories about him physically, you know, abusing subordinates. There's stories about him not paying vendors. I mean, in many ways, you could say that, you know, Harvey Weinstein was a sort of bit self-made and probably more genuinely talented kind of, you know, a Donald Trump who kept up Hampton's politics. But there were a lot of similarities. There was a kind of sense that, you know, that this guy was an out of control monster, and that basically, you know, the New York Times finally put this report together, and now it's going back decades in terms of these Weinstein abuses. And the natural question was, you know, and the smarter question was not to sort of, you know, beat up on, well, why didn't, you know, these women or other people who were abused as employees, why didn't they expose him? Well, I mean, that's kind of obvious why people might have been afraid to come forward or been sort of, you know, felt cornered into a legal settlement. But some of these behaviors were so flagrant, and some of the accusations against him were, are literally like things that were like, you know, publicly assaulting somebody. How did this not get criminal attention? Well, this is where a new report that you guys put together comes in.
Yeah, and that, you know, that was our first story into Cy Vance, and we basically found that Weinstein's longtime lawyer, David Boies, gave $10,000 to Vance's campaign a few months after Vance dropped the criminal investigation into Weinstein. And that investigation was specifically into allegations from that the New York Times reported from the Italian model Ambra Battilana, who said that Weinstein asked if her breasts were real, groped them, and stuck his hands up her skirt. So a couple months after that, Boies gives $10,000 to Vance, but that was also only a fraction of the total amount that Boies, his son, and his law firm partners gave to Vance over the years, which totaled in excess of $182,000. So it's true that, you know, a little wrinkle to this is that Boies did not specifically represent Weinstein in that 2015 sexual assault investigation. Mm-hmm. But he was Weinstein's lawyer for at least a decade before that at that point. And he clearly had a close relationship with Vance. You know, he had headlined a fundraiser for Vance previously. So it still certainly raises questions about a potential conflict of interest and impropriety there, especially when we're seeing what starts to look like a trend in this pattern of behavior with Vance.
Well, yeah, so you have the specifically the Weinstein case, but then the follow-up piece that you guys published on the 6th of this month is entitled Criminal Defense Firm Bankrolled Manhattan DA Cyrus Vance Kept Clients Out of Prison. So, I mean, what are the other kind of potentials, at least, of other kinds of cases we're talking about, and the kind of broader set of campaign contributions?
Well, it seems like, you know, there might be a trend here of sexual assault crimes. Mm-hmm. You know, so this back up for a second. This law firm in our second piece, Clayman and Rosenberg, they gave $42,000 to Vance's campaign, and several of their clients got extremely favorable deals that involved no jail time, and favorable deals, you know, as judged by, you know, other news outlets that were covering those cases at the time that were kind of surprised by the outcome of those cases. So one of those cases involved a gynecologist who sexually assaulted 6 pregnant women.
Jesus Christ.
He got no jail time. And he had to only register as the lowest level of sex offender. 2 months after that plea deal, Clayman and Rosenberg lawyers gave $3,000 to Vance's campaign. Mm-hmm. And at the time that plea deal came out, an article in the New York Daily News said it was not immediately clear why prosecutors offered him a jail-free deal that does not even require him to do community service or comply with probation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, Cy Vance is not known for being somebody who, as an example, was, you know, criticizing harsh punitive sentences for, you know, lower income people or people of color. He wasn't exactly known as a guy who was, you know, a crusading DA who wanted us to revisit the sort of punitive emphasis of our criminal justice system in favor of rehabilitation. This wasn't a guy who was out on the front line, you know, talking about why we... He wasn't at the press conference with Bill de Blasio when Rikers was getting shut down. So there isn't even this, you know, there isn't even some sort of corresponding, like, you know, this is just a DA who really doesn't believe, you know, that prison is a sort of option of last resort for just public protection. This is someone who's quite happy to hand down punitive charges and push for hard sentences.
He wasn't, he certainly wasn't in any meeting of prison abolitionists. And, in fact, there are lots of reports of him kind of maybe being a little overly harsh on kind of broken windows charges like turnstile jumping and things like that.
Right. So he's been totally on board with this sort of New York City, very, you know, Giuliani, Bloomberg tradition, somewhat modified by de Blasio, of kind of using public ordinances, lower level drug crimes and things like that to essentially police, communities of color and constrain populations and kind of create a New York that is safe and pleasant and very easy to manage for a serial sexually assaulting gynecologist so that he can avoid, jail and go hang out in Gramercy Park or wherever he was. What has been the response to both of these stories from the DA's office? I mean, what's kind of notable about this is that, the kind of broader campaign finance system, we all know that obviously money determines much of policy, and Congress, as an example, is obviously, totally beholden to kind of a small sector of sort of corporate interests. That's kind of common knowledge, but at the same time, usually these things are done in a little bit more of a sophisticated or bureaucratic or slightly subtle way. I mean, this just seems sort of shocking how overt it is, especially the Ivanka and Don Jr. thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, talking to people about these cases or, just seeing the responses come in to the articles on Twitter, I think people were even surprised to realize that it's the same kind of campaign finance system we have for Congress that we have for district attorneys. A lot of people don't even realize that that's how our political system works and that the justice system is dependent on those same kinds of well-connected, wealthy donors.
Are you looking at, are there more shoes to drop with Cy Vance specifically, and then taking off from what you said about, and of course, in other parts of the country, I mean, judges are elected to office. There's been a lot of things in the South and other parts where places where judges are elected, of essentially, definitely local oil interests as an example, just dictating state Supreme Court decisions with their kind of like handpicked candidates getting elected to office. It's a very serious issue because obviously this is a realm where, theoretically and platonically, we're talking about roles that are not, that are supposed to be less quote unquote politicized. So are you looking more at Cy Vance specifically, or is this going to, or potentially open up to, a broader set of investigations of DAs or judges, or this kind of, broader role of potential influence peddling in criminal and other judicial type of cases and policy?
Yeah, I mean, I can say that our investigations into Cy Vance's campaign finance is definitely ongoing, and it's likely there will be more to come on that. And we're certainly looking at the broader system beyond that, but for now we're definitely focusing on Cy Vance. I was just going to say, in terms of the response from his office you had asked about previously, I think maybe Friday or Saturday there was a piece in The Guardian where the DA office's spokeswoman Joan Valero characterized our Harvey Weinstein story as, quote, completely false. That was really astonishing for me to see, when we were literally just reporting on public records. I mean, as an investigative journalist, it's not like this article was based on some leaked confidential memo or an insider tip or some, shady underground garage meeting. Right. It wasn't even drudged up through Freedom of Information requests. This is, literally publicly available information that we just connected the dots between. Right. So to have an official spokesperson say my reporting is completely false is simultaneously baffling and really concerning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't even understand. I mean, is there anything around those quotes that expands on that? Because, I mean, unless they were going to somehow prove that, oh, you know, sorry, this isn't Jade, you know, you guys at International Business Times, this isn't even your fault. This stuff was just literally mislabeled on the public record, and we could see how that looked weird, but we've corrected it, and the money actually didn't come from any of these sources, and, you know, here's the documentation. That would basically be the only way that you could say that, and then even then, you would still be like, apologetic, you know, there's some problem at the sort right. of, you know, at the clerk's office or whatever.
Yeah, no, they have not said that any of the records we reported on were incorrect or mislabeled or anything like that. She threw out a couple of kind of straw men claims that we did not make in our story, mm-hmm. And said none of these things are true. And to my, which my response was just, yeah, we didn't say any of those things.
Right. You just reported on a specific. So yeah, I mean, if they're spinning that hard, there's probably obviously a lot more to come, and it really looks very, very bad. And I think, you know, it's important. There's a Trump angle and that whole, you know, Trump family enterprise thing and this sort of broader criminality and stuff. And then there's also, you know, the broader lesson to think of in terms of judges and DAs across the country. But there also is this real specific Manhattan angle of a time of in a city of such hyper inequality and kind of playground for the hyper rich, and like,
yeah.
Not all of it is just sort of, you know, policy and cultural favorability. This is also like quite literally how it happens. You know, this is how somebody who is down on their luck, you know, this is how somebody gets held in Rikers without being able to see a judge for ages, and is also, you know, potentially tortured and abused by guards and lost in a prison system. And this is how, you know, we have three strikes law or, you know, stop and frisk and everything else. And then at the same time, you know, some doctor can commit multiple sexual assaults and not go to jail. I mean, this is the kind of nitty gritty in Harvey Weinstein. It's sort of like an open secret who he is. This is the kind of nitty gritty of how it actually works in terms of the, you know, not even two tier justice system, basically just like, you know, sort of actually two tier injustice system, essentially.
Well, yeah. And the important thing I'd say for, you know, all your listeners to know in terms of that justice system is that everything that we described in these articles is probably entirely legal.
Right. Right. Well, Jay Cassano, International Business Times. Everybody should read this reporting. Really appreciate your time as always, Jay. Thank you.
Thanks, Michael. Always good to be here.
Okay, folks. We'll go to the fun half. Go straight to the fun half. We have plenty of sound for you. I'm going to call into the phones. The IMs are on. At 695 members for the Michael Brooks Show, 95 patrons. Yesterday, we released a program on the illicit history of the CIA destabilization and Michael Manley's Jamaica in the 1970s. Michael Manley was a democratic socialist leader. The CIA funneled weapons into Jamaica to destabilize his government. There's a lot of stories it leads to, from the kind of setting up of cocaine distribution networks in the 1980s in the United States, which some things happening in the 70s led to, as well as stories about why Bob Marley was shot in 1976. We're doing a lot of, you know, stuff like that in terms of the illicit history part of the show. And you can find the history of Silicon Valley fascism, history of the Third Way, the post game, everything. Things are really growing and doing well, and I'm excited for more and more people to check it out. And of course, if you just want to check out the first part of the show, get a flavor of it, 7 p.m. we're live tomorrow on Tuesday, and you can always find the clips on the Michael Brooks playlist on YouTube, and you can subscribe to it on iTunes at my Michael Brooks Show. And check out, I think we have about 123 or 24 reviews now on iTunes, and thank you. Mostly, they're very favorable. So thanks a million, everybody. Thanks, Matt. Thanks, David Slavik. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half. Welcome back. We're on the fun half. I'm Michael Brooks with Maddie Alek. Okay. All right, Matt.
I really like that Maddie thing.
Maddie. He's a good kid. You're calling from a 509 area code. Who are you? Where are you calling from?
Oh, my gosh. This is Ronald Reagan's creepy uncle.
Okay.
I'm just calling it. Calling in to well, I was listening to you guys on the commercial. I could hear you talking about Trump's new movie, Trump Without Money.
Trump Without Money.
I think that movie's been done.
What was the movie?
Oh, at the end of it, he just sells out to the mafia and becomes president. So.
No. I'm not talking about doesn't have as much money as he's lying about. I'm talking about literally does not have money. I'm talking about the guy doesn't.
Dad wasn't in real estate.
Yeah, dad was not a he's not a trust fund baby. He doesn't grow up with money. He would be in jail. He would.
Oh my God.
He would either
that would be the
best.
If somebody could convince him that would get good ratings, then he might do a Survivor Island style reality show.
No, he would not.
That would be outstanding.
He would not. No, I'm thinking he would. I think the scenarios would be he might potentially be like a lower level mafia affiliate who either went to jail or got clipped.
Like a Jack Ruby figure.
Yeah. Or like Henry Hill's like dumber younger brother if he existed. Or he would be in jail now for like passing bad checks. Something like that.
Something any one of us would already be in jail for. Well, I just want to thank you guys. I've taken to listening to the Nixon tape sped up at 1.5 speed now, thanks to Matt Lack.
nice.
Bon voyage.
and yeah, just a big time support of the show. I'm trying to get the word out there. I want to talk about gun control a little bit. I didn't get to hear most of today's show because I was working, but, you guys really, I was an ex-military, grew up, I got my first shotgun when I was like 12. Thank you, Dad. And
thanks, Dad.
Now I've totally 180. I have kids. I'm terrified of weapons now. But, what do you think this, next step is going to be for the U.S.? The NRA is, you know, they walked back a little bit with this bump stock thing. Is that just what's going to happen after every mass shooting? They're going to walk back a little bit of the insanity?
I don't
think so. Is that all we can hope for?
Only where it's opportunistic.
Yeah, like, only where it's opportunistic. I mean, you know, my thing is, my kind of angle on this is I just think that people make guns too much. I'm not saying it isn't a cultural issue, but people make it way too much. Like, it's like so many other things. Everything from a certain type of religious fanaticism here in the Middle East, or like, there is a culture of guns, partially that's organic and genuine and complicated to deal with.
And a result of colonization.
And the result of colonization, a result of Southern history.
Oh, yeah. That culture.
Yeah, but I mean, I also just think, though, that even the reason, though, that you don't see any type of movement on guns is not primarily because of people. It's primarily because of the power of the domestic arms cartel, which keeps this country held hostage and owns Republicans, period. And also the way they're able to activate a small band of truly insane people through things like NRA TV.
Well, I don't think it's that small. They activate a base throughout rural America that's in the millions that totally believes their propaganda.
Yeah,
and
it's in the millions.
I
mean, nationally,
with a lot of my friends.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of the guys I was in the military with, I just can't talk about that issue with them because they are completely in the camp of no regulations. It's a safer world if everybody is carrying around a 240 Gulf. And
that's insane.
Yeah.
What about other issues? Can you talk with them about other issues, or is that like the one thing that they're just completely crazy about?
Yeah, that's actually one of the main hitches. A lot of them are more reasonable about a lot of things. It's just where they get into the personal defense kind of thing. And I was there with them too. I mean, when I got out of the military, I wasn't political at all, really, which is insane for someone who was in the military. But, I was totally, we can go ahead and call it libertarianism. I was hook, line, and sinker, man.
Boo.
It was gross. And
so what switched you up?
I wanted to call in and actually, well, it was, it, damn it, it was Sam Cedar's debates with libertarians.
Like, wow.
Cruising through YouTube and thought I was going to watch this little guy, beta male with his glasses, get crushed by some hardcore libertarians.
And then all of a sudden, that little beta male just fucking destroyed. Because he would be like, okay, but what about clean drinking water?
You know, it's always...
And then they would be like, oh, well, the connection's bad, but if you want to have slavery, that's freedom.
It's nice. It's always nice to hear that because those things are very kind of interminable to go through every day. Like when we were doing a lot of those. Oh. Haven't been in a while, but like...
No, I think libertarians are terrified of the show now. And I also think libertarianism isn't trendy anymore either. I think a lot of libertarian. I think what would be
confusing time for libertarianism.
I think what would be interesting now is
it had a tide. It followed the Ron Paul tide, and now it's reeling back. But that was a serious movement for a while.
And I think people are either getting sane like you, or they're realizing like the logic of where I'm going basically means that I should just become a Nazi. Yeah, exactly. I think how it's splitting up.
The logical conclusions get a little scary. So thank you guys. Appreciate it. Keep up the good work.
Thanks,
I'll
boss.
I'll call again later.
Appreciate the call, man. Thanks.
Ronald Reagan's creepy uncle's not terribly creepy.
No, not terribly creepy. You're calling from 509 area code. Who are you? Where are you calling from?
Bro, is this Michael Butt from the Fake News Report?
Yes.
Dude. What the fuck? This is Donnie J.
Donald Trump Jr., everybody.
What the fuck, dude?
Well, what the
Talking
fuck?
Talking a lot of shit today.
I guess it did involve you sort of... not really even lucking your way, just kind of corrupting your way out of a corruption charge, huh?
Bro, my dad is 6'4", 310, and he's going to kick your dad's ass.
Is your dad really
tall? How tall is your dad, bro?
How tall is my
dad? How tall is your dad, bro?
Oh, my dad's only 5'8", man.
Give me a break. That's kill me in size, bro. He's about to get bit. He's about to get bitch slapped by the ultimate alpha male, Don Sr., my dad, bitch.
Do you really get along with your... Like, I read a report, it was a Facebook post, to be fair, but it struck me as true, that it was week before the election, I think, that you were really sad in college, and you would basically just drink yourself, like, past the point of no return pretty much every day.
Yeah, dude.
Yeah. College, but not like fun drinking. Like you weren't like the center of the party. You weren't getting girls. You just literally were like just drunk and depressed. And one day you were supposed to meet your dad and you came out to meet him and he didn't like the clothes you had on. And he smacked you in the face and told you to put on a suit. Is that true?
Yeah, bro. That's what's about to happen to your dad, bitch. Look, has my dad made me cry? Yeah, but I probably deserved it. And now I'm an alpha male, too.
So no, you're an alpha male,
paid
too.
Off. Look, bro. Me and Jesse Waters are going halfsies on a prostitute tonight. I was going to invite you, and now I'm not. I'm talking mad shit.
Totally okay with not getting that
yourself.
Invite. Okay. Thank you, Donald Trump Jr. Also, by the way, we were talking the other day on my show about callers knowing how to land things well. Ending that with go fuck yourself is a very solid land. I just want to follow up briefly in light of the Harvey Weinstein thing and this sort of Joe Rogan conversation we were having the other day. There's this whole cluster of people that, you know, on one hand, obviously I have no respect for, like, a Dave Rubin type. People like Rogan, who I think it sucks. I think, yeah, he's facilitating a lot of our alt-right garbage, but I have found him entertaining. I have found him interesting. I've enjoyed his show at times. And then this kind of whole broader cluster of people, like this guy Jordan Peterson, has become very trendy in this sort of kind of like soft neo-reactionary YouTube. And there's a lot of stuff to pick apart here with this sort of obsession with, you know, campus culture and PC run amok and all of this stuff. And I think it's very easy, if you want to, we can always identify some excess of a campus somewhere. More substantively, I think there's people who are on the actual left who are not opponents of social justice and understand that things like misogyny and sexism are in fact structural things that we need to overcome as part of any serious justice-oriented politics. But we have a critique of the kind of dumb wokeism of Twitter and BuzzFeed, and there's a substantive critique, and that's very important. And that's the kind of part of that interwar between the left and liberals. But I just, you know, was thinking in light of, like, you look at these falls, you know, Harvey Weinstein, Roger Ailes, and just these grotesque, disgusting monsters who used positions, and Bill Cosby, I mean, you can put on the list as well in a different way, but certainly on the list. Just in the sense that he wasn't a CEO. But he was certainly someone who obviously had a lot of power and exercised it to systemically abuse women. That's like the broader reality of this so-called out-of-control SJW culture. So for every like dumb story you could find about, you know, maybe this campus thing was stupid, or maybe even in fact this argument about identity is actually problematic from a left perspective, not something that, you know, Rogan or Jordan Peterson is going to articulate, but they can, you know, find, hey, you know, some campus story that's silly or whatever. Just remember that the broader trend and the broader context of a society that takes racism, sexism, structural abuse seriously is that we're just getting the tiniest. I mean, because imagine the endless amounts of abuse, as an example, in terms of sexual harassment in a work environment that still exists and is not addressed. The fact that we're even getting an inkling of it, of an Ailes or a Weinstein, is definitely in large part due to the evolving standards of a society which says things like that are fundamentally unacceptable. And that's the actual work. That's what the real conflict is over about a conversation about structural sexism, as an example. It's not, you know, this professor tweeted something goofy, this argument about a video game. It's about, is it safe to work? Are you being sexually assaulted at your profession? What kind of trade-offs do you need to make as a woman, right? And I just think that that's important to note as well, because so many people are getting lost in reactionary arguments, but they're also just getting lost in really fundamentally trivial nonsense that even if we were to agree with, would still be at the bottom of issues to worry about. And the broader trend of pushing these issues to the forefront obviously is vital for overcoming real things, not like, oh my God, these kids don't want Ann Coulter to talk at college, they are so sheltered. But like, how did somebody run a major media conglomerate for several decades and abuse scores of employees? What's that about? That's a serious thing. You're calling from a 512 area code. Who are you? Where are you calling from?
Hey, Michael. It's Tammy in Texas.
Hey,
Theology
Tammy.
OP on Twitter. We talked last Tuesday.
Yes. How you doing?
I'm doing good. In the interest of the fun half, just being the fun half,
yes,
I just want to say that I have given up my quest to be the last American female to get a cell phone.
Wow. You got a cell phone?
I didn't get one. An incredible guy, an OG techie and left-wing windmill tilter like myself, gave me one as a gift.
Oh, beautiful.
So I don't know how my levels are.
No, you're fine.
If I sound okay.
You sound
okay,
fine.
Great. I wanted to call in again because last Tuesday I was incredibly nervous.
No, you were great.
And you were... Go ahead.
No, I just said you were great. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh. Well, what I was going to say is you were trying to engage me in a really important conversation and my heart was beating too loud for me to hear you.
Oh.
And it was a conversation about evangelical faith in the South and class.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially the alliance between, I don't know what you call them. I think of them as the Horistocrats,
mm-hmm.
W-H-O-R, the Horistocrats, the oligarchs, the uh-huh. plutocrats, whatever uh-huh. you want to call them.
Right.
But their alliance with religious conservatives in the South.
Yeah.
To basically create this, I would say unholy alliance, but being an atheist, I'm not allowed to throw terms like those around. What I wanted to say is, I'm a Gen Xer, which means that I was born right before the Vietnam War started. So I am pretty much aware of life through the period where the Republican Party made common cause in reaction to the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, where basically where I lived through the period when Southern Dixiecrats abandoned the Democratic Party and made common cause with the Republican Party. And the people that midwifed that that movement mm-hmm. from one side to the other were originally something called the Moral Majority,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
which then became the Christian Coalition. And now we just think of as evangelicals.
Mm-hmm.
And, this is really important. I got a little bit of pushback that I was basically slamming all Christians. And I just want to say, I will align myself with anybody who believes in any faith or spiritual path who's fighting for what I'm fighting for.
Yeah, of course.
I greatly admire.
Of course.
I greatly admire Sister Simone Campbell of the Catholic faith. I greatly admire Reverend Dr. William Barber, who is, I believe, of this Disciples of Christ faith, which was my faith before my family moved into the evangelical church.
Mm.
But what I wanted to say is, when we talk about evangelicals in the South, you start to sound like a conspiracy theorist. If you basically lay out the timeline,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I kind of start the timeline at the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act in 68. And then in the early 70s, you've got the Powell Memo, which basically lays out an idea that we need to deorganize working people, people who work for a paycheck.
Yeah, we've talked. There's no doubt that, you know, we definitely talked about the Powell Memo. And if you go back also, I forget who wrote the book, but we had him on as a guest. He talked about right-wing parties and democracy. He's a Harvard researcher.
Yes, I remember that.
Yeah, look, and this is a global phenomenon. Look at Saudi Arabia. What's the relationship in Saudi Arabia? It's a royal family that sits on a massive amount of oil wealth, and they dispense patronage and allow a high degree of control of social policy to a religious establishment that's supposed to force and maintain social cohesion and confer sort of religious legitimacy on this royal family, which is really just
exactly.
so that's a global pattern, and the only thing that the right has, because the actual policy agenda is simply to deliver economic benefits for a fraction of the population. All they have is to use the energy of things like religious fundamentalism or xenophobia or bigotry or different group identities to leverage normal people to vote for them. So that's a global, there's nothing conspiratorial about it. That's how it works internationally.
But what I guess, because I don't live anywhere but where I live. And by the way, I lived in California for 10 years
mm-hmm.
and absolutely hated the personality of the place.
Mm-hmm. But what were you going to say about Texas, though?
Well, I live in the old Confederacy.
Mm-hmm.
So my knowledge of, like, living through this change that happened to Texas. And Ann Richards would not be possible now.
Mm-hmm.
Can we agree on that?
Yeah, sure. She's a former governor of Texas for everybody. She was, late 80s, early 90s? She was the governor?
Total badass.
Mm-hmm.
Total badass. Total, like, in your face, I'm 100% Texan and 100% good people at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
That is all gone now.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the thing that I just want to say is there is a kind of do not pity. Do not. There's a lot of, especially on the part of Bernie Bros, there's a lot of pity
mm-hmm.
for Southerners who threw in their lot with Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And there is this myth that they held their nose about Donald Trump's morality in order to throw in with him to get Gorsuch on the court and to get abortion made illegal, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
That's a myth. That is a myth. These evangelicals didn't vote for Donald Trump in spite of their faith. They voted for him because of their faith. And let me explain what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
There is people think about the New Testament and they think about Jesus's constant red letters about the poor and about the evils of the love of money and about the necessity to sell off to lay up stores of riches in heaven, not here on earth. And they say, how could these people have voted for Donald Trump?
Mm-hmm.
These people have bought into something called the prosperity gospel heresy,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
which is an Old Testament heresy that says in the Old Testament, God visited great riches and boons of sex and offspring and lands and cattle and riches on these great patriarchs of the Old Testament.
Well, thank you very much. No, I'm familiar with that too. I think, and we do have to jump in a minute. I think that the pushback, I agree with you partially. And I think that there is obviously a debate right now that isn't just about Southern evangelicals. It's about a lot of different types of people that I think actually get pushed together in ways that are unhelpful, to be honest. But yes, there's this basic notion of, you know, is one side essentially just, well, deplorable, or is, you know, this kind of support for people like Trump misdirected populism or angst, or even, I guess in your case, you're talking about people with just kind of genuine religious convictions about things like abortion, which I don't frankly have much time for either. I think the truth of the matter is that obviously a vast majority of people who voted for Trump were, and we always say this, they're just Republicans. And the Republican Party is a plutocrat social reactionary party of which Donald Trump is the perfect representative of. Now there is well, I mean, I don't, you know, I don't know what's profitable. I think that though it's what's important though is there is a chunk of people that can be pulled off. And that's who we need to focus on. And a broader rhetorical strategy that opens that ability is helpful. Whether we pity people or not, I don't, you know, pity means different things to different people. I don't pity these people, but I sure am interested in how the situation got as bad as it is and, you know, the context behind it. I think that's all.
Do you remember when we talked about brainwashing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I do. Yes.
The non-evangelical brainwashing that has taken place for the non-evangelicals, the brainwashing that has taken place is the wholesale purchase of this idea that our political and economic system means everybody can be rich.
Right.
People have been brainwashed to believe that. And they voted for Donald Trump, and this is going to sound bizarre, but I promise you it's not. It's true. Because they thought he's going to get into office and tell us all the secret.
Right. Right.
And make us all rich.
Right.
It is.
Sec.
And what I'm saying is,
real quick, because we do have to jump.
You cannot talk somebody who believes that nonsense out of it. I agree with you that we need to come up with a rhetorical strategy.
But we could probably talk somebody who voted that way in, you know, Michigan out of desperation out of it. I don't think there's anybody, even my, you know, and speaking as a Bernie bro, I guess, whatever the hell that means, I have no illusions about flipping Southern evangelicals. My main political concern in the South is voting rights for people of color and attempting to organize, you know, the emergent reality of those places to overturn essentially white supremacy fused with, you know, this very, very toxic and deranged religiosity. But I do think that as a message matter, we need to be bold and confident and reach out to everyone. And then we also need to make these distinctions because, you know, there is a very big difference. And again, not just I think voting for Donald Trump, as I've said a million times, is an act of white supremacy in and of itself. But somebody who did that in a sense of desperation in the industrial Midwest and had voted for Obama before is a radically different voter than the type of voter you're talking about. So that's the kind of distinction we need to make. But I do need to jump. Thank you so much for the call.
No, you got to let me. You got to let me defend myself. You said I called you a Bernie bro as a pejorative.
Oh, no. I didn't take it like that. Not at all.
I mean when I say Bernie, I don't consider you a Bernie bro.
Oh, okay.
When I say Bernie bro, what I mean is people who say if we can't have Bernie, Trump is fine.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely nobody. I don't think anybody listening to this show would think that. That's a delusional position. Of course. Thank you so much for the call.
All right.
I'll talk to you again soon. Thank you. Bye-bye. Okay. So Senator Bob Corker, who is that the clip you have up?
No, sorry. This is the football stuff.
Oh, this is the football stuff. Okay, let's do the football stuff. So Mike Pence, who is just as despicable as Donald Trump, look into his record in Indiana on voter suppression. Look into his record on assaults on women's health. Look at his record going back, you know, as a not only just a person who, of course, voted for the invasion of Iraq, he was a prime advocate of the invasion of Iraq. He wants to get in on this NFL far-right virtue signaling. And how did he do that? Well, I don't like to frame things this way, but this was literally if you want to look at stuff like this, a hilarious, massive misuse of public resources and time and a craven display to get on the news cycle. And this is a CNN panel breaking down the situation with Vice President Mike Pence.
All right. I also want to bring up something that just happened today at the NFL at a game, Indianapolis Colts. Vice President Mike Pence was there, but then tweeting a short time ago that he left the Colts game over players kneeling during the anthem, and then writing this: "I left today's Colts game because a president of the United States, and I will not dignify any event that disrespects our soldiers, our flag, or our national anthem at a time when so many Americans are inspiring our nation with their courage, resolve, and resilience. Now more than ever, we should rally around our flag and everything that unites us. While everyone is entitled to their own opinions, I don't think it's too much to ask NFL players to respect the flag and our national anthem." So Brian, I mean, this kind of also underscores it's back to the kneeling, the form of protest. So many players say it's not about the flag, but it is instead a statement being made about social injustices, but the vice president underscoring that he sees it as an issue of the flag. So what is the message that's being sent by the vice president tweeting this and refusing to be at the game?
In some ways, I think it's back to a culture war issue that Trump and Pence felt they were winning on. This was big news 2 weeks ago. It faded away. Now it's back thanks to Pence's visit. I've got to be cynical about this for a moment, Fred. The Vice President Pence was in Las Vegas yesterday speaking solemnly about the massacre there. Then he flew home to Indiana. He spent the night in Indiana. He went to the game today. He's about to head back to the West Coast. So it makes you wonder if he purposely wanted to go to the Colts game today in Indiana in order to make this kind of statement, knowing that 49ers players were almost guaranteed to kneel. There's been players on the San Francisco team kneeling every single game. So Pence and his team heading to the game today, they had to have known there was going to be kneeling. His statement almost seems written ahead of time. It seems like this was a staged moment for Pence to walk out to make a statement about this. But clearly he feels strongly about these anthem protests. He wants.
Brian, I'll help you. It was premeditated. It's lazy. It's pathetic. It's sort of so ham-handed and comically obvious what Mike Pence is doing here that it's embarrassing for everybody involved.
Well, and it's repetitive because this is what Pence did when he went to Hamilton too, right?
Yes.
Like, it's sort of the exact same thing. I'm going to go someplace and be offended by the people on stage that, you know, our voters can't identify with for whatever reason.
And again, this just strikes me in light of this, like, YouTube conversation that the left is, like, the party of the perpetually offended. Because we might say, like, hey, I thought your comment about Puerto Ricans being lazy while we're viciously savaging them with austerity, not responding seriously enough to a catastrophe, I thought that was a fucked up thing to say. That means that, like, we're always triggered. But these guys will take a plane trip to intentionally choreograph offense about athletes exercising their free speech rights, incidentally, to highlight an issue that, you know, I don't know, maybe being black and getting fucking murdered by a police officer is a little bit more important than Mike Pence's feelings. Or the feelings he's pretending to so deeply have so he can trigger his base. Because if you want to have a conversation about everybody being too reactive and too caught in a news cycle and too triggered, we can have that. But that's going to be about pretty much every American at this point. This country is in need of a global meditation retreat. But the notion that this is somehow identifiable with the left, when a prime activity of this White House, when they're not trying to take away people's health care, give away massive tax cuts, killing civilians overseas, or rolling back any progress on climate and anti-corporate corruption and public health, their prime mode of activity is white identity politics, cultural aggrievement, and finding things to be offended about. That's what that is literally the only areas of competency that the modern right has. And it's quite an impressive jiu-jitsu to make that a conversation about the left. Follow-up sound here. This is 49ers safety Eric Reed talking about Pence and calling Pence what Pence did what it obviously was.
My honest reaction, does anybody know the last time he's been to a football game? Okay, with that being said, he tweeted out a 3-year-old photo from at a Colts game. So with the information that I have, last time he's been to a Colts game was 3 years ago. So this looks like a PR stunt to me. He knew our team has had the most players protest. He knew that we were probably going to do it again. And so this is what systemic oppression looks like. A man with power comes to the game, tweets a couple of things out, and leaves the game with an attempt to thwart our efforts. Again, based on the information I have, that's the assumption that I made.
That's exactly right. And also, not only to, you know, it's a PR stunt. He's exercising his power to try to oppress normal citizens exercising their free speech. It's embarrassing. It's pathetic. Could you imagine the types of death threats that these players are getting? Okay. And the type of verbal and racial abuse that no doubt they get from the stands. And when Mike Pence does this, he's winking at all of that.
And intensifying it.
It's disgusting. I mean, it's a sort of classic mode of Mike Pence of just utterly craven and disgusting, but also just sort of silly and pathetic at the same time. You're calling from it says +266. Are you there?
Is that me?
That's you.
That's me. Oh, God, sorry.
No worries,
man.
I
felt like I was just listening to a radio show there. I'm calling from Skype. I tried to call your official Skype, but didn't work. I'm calling from Seoul.
Oh, hey, man. What's your name?
My name's Matt.
Okay, so what are you doing in Seoul, Matt?
I'm just a teacher.
Cool. Very cool.
Been living here for a couple of years now, and I listen to your show every day.
Oh, cool.
Or just about.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I'm Canadian. But
I caught that.
It's good to keep tabs on what's going on in the U.S., especially when you're here.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. And I heard you guys wondering, you guys said it on the show the other day, what must it be like to be living in Seoul right now? and so I thought I'd call in and tell you what it's like.
Yeah, go ahead.
Now, I'm obviously a foreigner. I'm a bit clueless. I don't really speak the language and all that, but it's different here now, or it feels that way to me. I lived here for a couple of years now, and I lived here once before, too, many years ago, and I had never occurred to me before that anything was going to happen with North Korea. I mean, you got to understand just how, like, poor and weak that country is. Like, I was trying to find something to compare. Mm-hmm. It's got, North Korea's GDP is, like, half of Huntsville, Alabama. That was the closest U.S. city I could find for comparison.
So the people in South Korea, like, obviously, you know, they're developing a weapons. Like, what North Korea is threatening to do and occasionally does do has some logic to it. It's, you know, horrible, but there's a logic to it. Mm-hmm. But I'm saying, in terms of anybody being, like, you know, people have been kidnapped from Japan by North Korean operatives. There has been, you know, back and forths between mm-hmm. North Korea and South. So we here in the United States have, like, nothing right now even remotely to worry about directly from North Korea. Like, if this thing that Trump keeps hinting at happens, it will basically just be like a horrific war crime that the United States visits on North Korea, and then the fallout would be on South Korea and Japan. So I get, but somehow in the popular discourse in America, there's the, you know, it's another kind of, you know, it's hyped up. There's this real fear about this guy. In South Korea, even though the threat is actually real, like it could decimate Seoul, is there a more, like, not that they aren't afraid and concerned about the North Korean regime and not afraid and concerned about, you know, whatever irrationality Trump has planned, but that are they also at the same time more aware that, of course, like, the North Korean regime is vindictive and dangerous and horrific to its own people, but it's nothing like half the GDP of Huntsville. Like, it isn't this big, you know, global monolith that almost starts to get presented with to some degree in the United States. I mean, it's pretty ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, the people here are, they're weirdly cool with things. They're weirdly calm. I guess it's just a matter of having been officially at war for most of their living memory, even the new president here. I mean, I don't know that he was born when the Korean War ended, mm-hmm. but the armistice was signed. You mm-hmm. know? Mm-hmm. So it's just what they've been living with all their lives, and they're weirdly calm about it. I mean, and I was too, and I didn't even know, for instance, until Trump was elected, I didn't know where my local bomb shelter was. Now I do.
Right.
And I saw a news story recently that most Koreans still don't know. I think this is a real busy, high-stress country, and I think they kind of keep it out of their minds most of the time. Hmm. And I think they're used to the idea. There's a surprising amount of, like, cooperation between South and North Korea. There's the humanitarian aid.
Right.
They've marched together at the Olympics and stuff like this. And, you know, when things are calm here, they're pretty calm. But right now, it's starting to feel a lot less calm.
Right. Right. Anything else to add?
Not so much, but when I'll just say that when I hear it used as a political football in America, that concerns me because, I mean, when you think about who you guys have running your country right now, I would much rather if when Trump failed to live up to his tough talk about North Korea, everybody just let that slide.
And I agree. I think that that's a very... Every time else. I hear there's a certain type of hashtag resistance person that does it like, yeah, you're not going to get your wall now, huh? And it's like, shut the fuck up.
Uh-huh.
You're trying to, like, make this guy feel obligated to fulfill his insane rhetoric. I agree. I think if we could all just say, you know, I think, frankly, that T.I. would be a much better apprentice host than you, Mr. President, and hopefully that will distract him. You know, long
absolutely just fill his Twitter feed with just NFL stuff, something.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyways, that's all I had to
all add. Right, thanks, boss. Appreciate the call.
If anything changes here, I'll call you back.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye. All right, let's run through the sound. So Senator Bob Corker, and we'll let's start with the sort of Corker drama, and then we'll get to kind of some of the substance of the Iran deal. Senator Bob Corker is a very right-wing senator from Tennessee. He is not seeking re-election. He was supposedly on the short list, and I do mean short, to be Trump's Secretary of State. And apparently, we reported a couple months ago, or we commented on a report a couple months ago, that the reason that Corker was not picked by Trump was at his, I believe it's 5'4". I've read that he's 5'5", but he lists him, or 5'4", but he kind of tries to, you know, throw himself a bit more. And Trump was like, that's just not. It's like, Luther Strange is a freak here. You're a freak here. So Bob Corker, though, has had tension with Trump, and it's recently kind of exploded. No surprise, because he's not seeking re-election. I have no doubt that if Bob Corker was planning on staying in the Senate, he would still be essentially aiding and abetting Trump. You know, typical kind of more traditional, just sort of far right-wing kind of business conservative guy. He has said, and this is from a report in the New York Times, that Trump's recklessness threatens World War III. In an extraordinary rebuke of the president of his own party, Mr. Corker said he was alarmed about the president who, quote, acts like he is doing The Apprentice or something. He concerns me. He would have to concern anyone who cares about our nation. He went on to say that, in fact, Trump could get us into World War III. And he's referring, not just to the North Korea stuff, but actually also potentially to the Iran stuff. And if Trump, in fact, does decertify the Iran deal, he's going to have to deal with Corker's committee, as well as having to replace Rex Tillerson if he does indeed fire him. I do think that Corker is genuinely part of the Trump is a fucking moron contingent. And it should not earn anybody high praise to recognize the obvious that, of course, Trump is a fucking moron. And here is a report that kind of brackets it, because, of course, with Trump, everything got on onto Twitter. An NBC news report on the Trump-Corker feud.
Tonight, piercing criticism of the president by a fellow Republican. Senator Bob Corker tweeting, it's a shame the White House has become an adult daycare center. Someone obviously missed their shift this morning. Those sharp words, retaliation for President Trump's latest Twitter tirade, attacking Corker as a negative voice obstructing his agenda, and a coward who didn't have the guts to run for re-election. The president's budget director an hour earlier praising Corker.
I think it's going to be fun to work with him, especially now that he's announced that he's not running for re-election, because I think it sort of unleashes him to do whatever he wants to say.
Corker, head of the powerful Senate Foreign Relations Committee, just days ago, taking this apparent swipe at the president's competence.
I think Secretary Tillerson, Secretary Mattis, and Chief of Staff Kelly are those people that help separate our country from chaos.
So there you have it. And this comes on top of, you know, Trump is still ranting about the Iran deal. Now, there's obviously a contingent inside the White House, and it is still the mainstream. Any Republican president, and I think, in fact, a guy like Rubio would be even more likely to ruin the Iran deal than Trump, because he's fully, you know, he's just a sort of airhead bagman for neoconservative interests. What they tried to do during the Obama, and I mentioned this before, I'll just go over it again briefly. What they tried to do during the Obama negotiations and the Kerry negotiations with our partners and the Iranian government was to add these poison pills. So that agreement was actually very strictly about the nuclear program and our sanctions relief. It was a very direct. And then, of course, once you're there building negotiations and building relationships and kind of cooling relations a bit, and giving a kind of modest improvement, there's always the possibility that that will have ancillary benefits for other areas of cooperation and other potentially shared sources of interest against, you know, ISIL as an example. But it was not a global deal. It wasn't a deal about Hezbollah. It wasn't a deal even about missiles. It wasn't a deal about delivery systems. It wasn't a deal about, you know, recognizing Israel. It was not a full package towards full normalized relations. It was sanctions relief and constraints on the nuclear program, which everybody, including the Trump administration, which has been certifying it under Tillerson, acknowledges that they have been following. And it makes sense that the small, quote-unquote, realist contingent, or the small kind of occasional sort of shoots of some sanity around this situation in this administration would say something like this. This is from a hearing that took place last Tuesday in the Senate Armed Services Committee. Senator Angus King, independent of Maine, asked Secretary of Defense James Mattis what he thought of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which is the Iran deal, whether the United States should stay in it or pull out.
Secretary Mattis, very quick, short answer question. Do you believe it's in our national security interest at the present time to remain in the JCPOA? That's a yes or no question.
Yes, Senator, I do.
Thank you.
And it's obvious why it would be the case. One, the deal is working, which means that from a U.S. perspective, Iran's potential of a nuclear weapons program is significantly reduced and monitored and constrained. It's also a business opportunity as sanctions are lifted and foreign direct investment flows into Iran. There's contracts for companies like Boeing to help rebuild Iranian air fleets for their airline industry, as an example. And then number three, it totally destroys. I mean, you have two examples now. If we pull out of this Iran deal, and then you look at what was a comprehensive agreement, that Gaddafi did make with Bush and Blair many years ago, and was a main partner on terrorism, which of course meant that he, along with Assad, was a partner in the global torture program in this so-called war on terror. Look what happened to Gaddafi. And the only logical lesson that a country like Iran can draw is we should have nukes. And the supreme leader, while endorsing and allowing Rouhani to pursue negotiations, also said something to the effect in Farsi of you can do it, but I know that they cannot be trusted. Well, okay. And this isn't just Republicans. Every single member of the Democratic caucus besides Bernie Sanders voted on an Iran sanctions package. Not even a Democrat. And he's not even a Democrat, as so many idiots on Twitter endlessly point out to me, as if that's something I'm supposed to care about. Did you know that Bernie was the only person to defend President Obama's greatest foreign policy achievement and one of the sort of core building blocks not leading to an even next level of escalation?
Why does he hate Democrats so much?
Yeah, exactly. Of crisis and death in the Middle East. He's not even a Democrat! I mean, yeah. Gee, I wonder why. Why would the most popular politician in the country not subcontract his political identity to a party that is so fucking unpopular that they're still less popular than the fucking trust fund baby fascist president? What the fuck is wrong with these people? I did a whole tour with fucking... Oh my God. I did a whole tour with Tom Perez. I tried to teach him how to do this shit. Look at that guy. He failed in all his fundraising goals. Now he's teaching a class at Brown. But meanwhile, you're fucking harassing me. I should be retired in Sarasota and I have more energy than all these people, but yet you people...
Nobody's the problem. I don't care. Yeah. I don't give a shit about people. Yeah.
Tom Perez at his best when he's cursing. What happened to that? They went through all this effort to make sure that Keith Ellison was not DNC chair. And apparently Obama worked the phones and all of this shit. And then Perez gets it, fails his fundraising targets, and is still there, but also like teaching college.
Teaching at Brown.
Yeah, teaching at Brown. I guess Brown's nice. I spent some time at Brown in college. Good people, hookah bars. I don't like what the fuck. And these idiots bitch about Bernie Sanders. It's unbelievable. Ugh. And all of them, I will say. I mean, this is why. I mean, you know, it's like the reasons that I will probably support Bernie Sanders again if he runs in 2020 are, number one, because of course I do not want women or minorities to be in elected office because I'm a socialist, so obviously. Number two, I mean, all these people, including people I like Elizabeth Warren, I really like Elizabeth Warren. I would like to, you know, if she could just expand the sphere a little bit. Warren, Harris, everybody voted for Iran sanctions. I know it was part of a Russia sanctions bill. I'm sorry. Sanctioning Russia again is not a fifth as important as preserving this deal with Iran.
The Warren president stuff, it just makes me feel sad because she's the type of person where I just like her to stay in the Senate and lock that Senate seat down and be good on the Senate.
I think she could truly be a icon of the Senate and get a lot of good stuff done. No doubt about it. But I don't know. It's funny. It's amazing. Like just the depreciation of talent. Cause I was thinking too, it's like the best centrist politician in the country is Jerry Brown. it's like, why is it that it's these politicians in their late 70s? You're calling from a 610 area code. Who are you? Where are you calling from?
Hi, this is Chris from Pennsylvania.
Hey, Chris, what's going on?
Hey, I just wanted to talk about Navient.
Talk about what?
Navient, the student loan corporation.
Oh, okay, yeah, those evil bastards, yes.
Yeah. The sure. only thing, I do want to say that, J.T. Brown was the first hockey player that raised his fist, and he already received death threats.
Yep.
It's not about the, you know, it's not about the protest itself, right?
Yeah, of course. Right.
Yeah, but the Attorney General, Josh Shapiro in Pennsylvania, officially sued Navient.
Good.
And that's actually a bigger, like a huge deal, because Navient is actually, some of them, one of its headquarters is in Pennsylvania.
Mm.
And so the other, I think it was like Illinois and Washington, they don't have like direct jurisdiction.
Yeah.
Where Pennsylvania is. And if the CFPB is going to be completely like gutted in the next year or so, then
Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of going to be up to Shapiro. And he wants like full restitution and then to give back their profits and halt.
It's great.
On all the loans and everything. So,
that's really great. That's great. It's an important case.
So I just need to bring that up, and I don't know.
There should be universal student debt relief, period. It would be great for the economy. It would do something for inequality, and it would punish these parasitic companies. There should be national student debt relief, period. Done. There should be retroactive free college for anybody still dealing with loans, period.
Yeah, and he said one of the things is that he decided to pursue it because the U.S. Department of Education has basically decided not to because they're on the side.
Yeah, of course.
Betsy's busy.
Yeah, Betsy's got things to do. I mean, look, that the student, look, you could take the Department of Education as a microcosm of republicanism. What do you do? You go out of your way to support fraudulent online universities. You're going to do even same with Obama, get rid of the most modest steps the Obama administration took to protect former students from all of these predatory companies. And then where are you going to put your real attention? After, because all that stuff is great. You just don't have to enforce rules or relax rules. And then you get to the real focus of discriminating against transgender students and relaxing rape rules. And then, you know, turn on Dave Rubin and, you know, find out that the fact that, you know, I don't know, Ben Shapiro had to like relocate a talk or something is the, you know, main crisis point in Western civilization. There are threats to so-called Western civilization's achievements, but real achievements like free speech and open society. And it's called conservatives. It's not a fucking refugee from Syria. I appreciate the call, man. Thank you.
All right. Can you tell Cliff, stop retweeting Evan McMullen?
You tell him that.
Yeah, tell him that. Tell him that.
He didn't respond. I found him on Twitter.
He didn't respond. Well, all I can assure you is that I will not retweet unless I am quote tweeting and insulting Evan McMullen, David Frum, Jennifer Rubin, or who else is on the list of these horrible people that all of a sudden get to be okay?
Albright, what, Sally Albright? Is that
Sally Albright. She's a whole other. She makes like David Frum look like a paragon of sanity and virtue, and she's not as important as those people. But I will not be retweeting any of them. All right, thank you, man.
Speaking of, you know, Ben Shapiro needing security to go to campus events.
Yeah.
You know, it struck me reading the Milo expose that Antifa tactics regarding, you know, heightening the tensions and, you know, they forced Mercer to put his security with Milo.
That's right.
Explicitly one of the goals of Antifa and roughing those crowds up is to like force their hand and like need them to sort of exposed themselves, and it worked. So just like to register that.
I know, that's a really good point. Uchiwali, how are you going to commemorate Che Guevara's death? Matt, what do you have in store for the day?
I'm going to produce some podcasts today.
I'm going to produce some leftist podcast content. If Che were alive today, he would be a podcast producer. I'm going to, I'm going to smoke a Cuban. Hang out with some people, drink some rum. No, I don't know. I don't know. Unfortunately, will probably be. I have dinner plans, and then I have to do show prep for my show tomorrow. That's what I'll do. Chris Lopaco, Trump said they turned down the cheering so people could hear the announcements. Does that mean that the cheering was recorded and being played through speakers? I don't know.
He's always talking about how it plays on camera. So they have like the room mic and the PA mic, and he's very, very paranoid about how he does this all the time about how they're playing that. Yeah, they turned down the applause. It was in the room. You couldn't even hear. They're breaking all their recording equipment. People cheering too loud for their paper towels.
Yeah, didn't want you to see that. The people of Puerto Rico.
They love when you say that.
They really
like Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico.
This guy is such trash. Jesus Christ. Colonial company. Companies. I'd like to see Trump give an example of something he thinks he's done, quote unquote, badly.
Toile de papel.
Teacher BB, is there also a Trump angle to the Vance story in that the default now is to say the media lies even in cases where you're caught lying? Very disturbing. Yeah. Well, it is. I mean, there is that evolution of like all politicians lie and distort. But even right-wing media, like I've tried to make that point that like when I first like watched Fox and stuff, they lied all the time, of course, because it's a propaganda network. But they had to like. It was like omit a statistic, lie about. I mean, you know, people still do this all the time, but it was different from. But now it's like, you know, just make up worlds. You know, like Jones, Cernovich, like it just Breitbart. That's just it's just a complete. So I think that yeah, like, what would be like? What would the equivalent would be like? Monica Lewinsky, never heard of her. You know, it wouldn't be like definition of is. It would just be like, I know that I said that. I didn't say that.
An optimistic read on this dynamic is that it it's never been easier for a lot of this shit to rise to the surface and become public because there's so many outlets. It's so easy to get information. Like, think of how much of Obama's admin is dominated by Snowden and Manning leaks.
Right.
And so you have to just, if stuff's going to get out, you just have to discredit the messenger. It's coming from a sign of weakness, I think. Like, I think there are, like, very powerful people, like Weinstein, for instance, the right. O'Reilly Ailes, like, all that stuff. They realize, like, just people in general that have shit to hide, but they're powerful, that we are entering a new time of, like, sort of forced transparency. And it's not necessarily positive in every way, but it's definitely different, and people have to react to it.
And there are positive aspects of it, obviously.
Definitely.
Nick from San Francisco. I don't think Harvey Weinstein has ever assaulted anybody. In fact, no woman has been genuinely assaulted since the mid-1970s. And I'm a progressive. Joke. Yes. That was the Wozniak's Fox News pitch. Say Harnamer. Hey, Michael, longtime listener and became a member last year. Will soon become a patron of your show, too. Well, thank you very much, my friend. The TMBS Army. Interesting discussion on Vance. And speaking of fucked up DAs, not sure you know this, but here in LA, we have the most murderous police department in the country. I did know that part. Neither the police commissioner nor our DA, Jackie Lacey, have ever held these killer cops accountable. During her term, Lacey has failed to prosecute almost 300 cops in the past 4 years. This includes the murder of Keisha Michael and Marquinton Sandlin, loving parents of a seven-year-old who were killed while sleeping in their car. Fucking disgusting, right? Yes, that is fucking disgusting. So we have a petition going to get the DA Lacey to do her fucking job. It's bit.ly/BLMLA, caps BLMLA. Can you post this? Matt, would you mind?
Yeah, bit.ly/BLMLA.
Yes. Yes, we'll post that on the blog, definitely. Especially if you're in LA, but really anywhere, please sign. If we can get some progress in eliminating the most murderous forces, then there's something that could have a butterfly effect throughout the country. Thanks. bit.ly/BLMLA. We'll definitely post that. Thank you. That's really disgusting. Epish. Harvey Weinstein is a big Robin Hood Foundation guy, isn't he? Yep. A whole lot of interesting names on that Robin Hood Foundation board. Send that to me.
That'd I've not heard of the Robin Hood Foundation.
It's sort of a, I mean, it's a great name. I'm a big Robin Hood fan. No, but it's kind of like, it's basically, you know, it's sort of like kind of liberal plutocrat sort of organization, essentially. Great to hear from Texas again. I suggest you all check out Kevin Cruz's One Nation Under God. We had him on the show. A lot of capital appropriation of religious and cultural space has to do with blocking labor's use of church for organizing. Absolutely. And undercutting social justice and religiosity. Look at what happened to the Barragans. At least Dan was able to live quietly up at Fordham and wasn't murdered like MLK and Malcolm X. Just to be clear, your conversation from last week was great. I was saying that I thought we saw things similarly. Yes. Epish, is annealing a microaggression? Exactly. That's what Mike Pizzo is. Such a microaggression against the flag. Joseph Ballin, with the recent revelation that Trump would decertify the Iran deal, I don't know if that's confirmed yet, but it's certainly looking like it. Label the Iranian Revolutionary Guard terrorist, yes, organization. Fight with Tillerson over back channels with DPRK. The THAAD missile sales to Saudi Arabia and accusing Iran of funding the DPRK. It's painfully obvious the fascist Trump is clearly preparing for war with either Iran or North Korea both at the same time. The tension. I also don't appreciate your attack on Jason Unruh. I am very concerned about those moves as well. Jason Unruh is not good. He's just some sweaty bastard on YouTube. Comrade Jeb, have you seen the new racist Dove ad? I did. That is so... It's so racist. It's such a brand F up, as we would say in Two Dope Boys in a podcast parlance, that like it's one of those classic examples where even as a comedy sketch, you'd say that's too on the nose. It drives home the point of how widespread racism is within the corporate world that supposedly got past entire ad copy teams, legal teams, and various other approved processes. Here's an ad if you here's the ad if you haven't seen it. I don't have a way of sending this to Matt, but do you want to just grab that that Dove ad? We'll do it tomorrow. Okay. But yes, you're absolutely right. Shield Jaguar. Is there a reggae version on La Poupée for Michael Monday? That's a good point. It's a very good point.
Actually, I have no idea, seems but I'm like guessing there probably be, right? is. Yeah.
Seems like there would be.
I feel like there's a law that's passed for like the recording industry or something.
I want like a late 80s like LA gangster rap version of it too. Anthony, for Baltimore, you probably already saw this, but Betsy DeVos is giving a commencement speech for the graduating class of University of Baltimore this year, which is my alma mater. Anyway, Kurt Schmoke, UB's president and former mayor of Baltimore. Oh, Schmoke's a pretty interesting guy, right? Reached out, apparently suggested that Trump Education Department LLC reached out to him initially to have Betsy speak at the commencement ceremony, perhaps to deflect responsibility. This is just a rumor, though, but Schmoke, I had only heard of Schmoke. I thought Schmoke had called for drug legalization, but this makes him sound terrible. But Schmoke, who's a proponent of school vouchers, has a cousin that used to be president of DeVry University, an online scam for-profit college that is part of the Trump Education Department, LLC. Schmoke refuses to rescind the invitation to Betsy DeVos following a student walkout a few weeks ago on the basis of supporting "quote unquote" free speech. They will likely be protests the day of the ceremony. I hope so. And Schmoke should be fired. That's disgusting. Cuck the police. If Trump didn't have money, he would have been drafted and died cowering in a hole in Vietnam. Yes, that's very possible. Bull Prague, although he might have failed some psych tests. Bull Prague. Todd Glass describing being PC is not saying something because you won't want to deal with the backlash rather than legitimately not saying it, but put the blame on the others for why you don't say it. Okay. I mean, look, I have a critique of all of this sort of, for lack of a better word, kind of pseudo woke discourse. Those are some themes that in some cases I probably explore a lot more on my show, but And some of these conversations are important. And there's also, it's a world, you know, there's an important critique of someone like Ta-Nehisi Coates that needs to be made. There's also an incredibly stupid critique of him that questions the reality that, of course, America is a white supremacist country. And, of course, there are through lines of materially grounded racism and apartheid in the United States. If you can't accept... There's a lot of debate to be had about so-called PC stuff. But if you can't accept certain historical realities and ground rules of experience, then you're just either deluded and wrong, or you have the different political agenda than I do. And if you're just sort of obsessed with these relatively trivial conversations, I just think, you know, we're doing different things. Petrus, Ree Vance's story. Whatever story like this comes out, it's always surprising how little it takes to buy these people. I guess if you take a little, I guess if you take a little from here and there, it adds up. Ree Weinstein, I don't know the particulars of the situation, but Hollywood has its own ecosystems and rule sets. As long as everyone gets what they want, they're cool with abuses. I'm not defending Weinstein's misbehavior, but Jenny from Texas wants to get ahead. Oh, I don't agree with that at all. I don't agree with that. Nick from Manitoba. Hey, Michael, great interview, great composure and intellectual finesse.
Your composure was excellent, I thought. I thought that Jay was very difficult and you...
Right, exactly. Jay was unhinged to work. Now, I just want to tell you in advance that Sam isn't here today. I might make you the butt end of free jokes in my future IMs in order to boost Sam's self-esteem. It's nothing against you. You know how to bring it. It's just Sam, on the other hand, with these pressing times, needs his petty ego to be tickled sometimes for the show's sake, to say the least. Stay sweet, MR beauties. Well, maybe I need my ego stroked as well. Don't pit Sam and I against each other. We do enough of that on our own. Sam underscore, Sam Cedor. Hey, Michael, this is Paul from Switzerland. I wanted to congratulate you guys on your fifth award. I love your show, and I feel it really deserves it. Thank you. I have a quick question. In addition to the fact that we Swiss don't give a shit about our neighbors and will never help our friends, yeah, Huntsman is right, we have a direct democracy. Unfortunately, as in most countries, the older generation voters much more than the younger ones, and therefore the country leads more conservative and right-wing. And this is what we've seen recently in most European countries, Brexit, etc. Do you think that there would be a system where younger voters... Do you think there should be a system where younger voters should have more weight than the older voters? I know this initiative here to do it, but it completely failed. What's your opinion of it on that? Love the show. Left is all that's left. That's a good slogan. I don't believe, I guess, in any actual principle that would specifically weight a vote more than the other. I'm interested in a lot of different voting reforms. I think actually, I mean, I don't know what difference it would make, but I'd be really interested in testing out lowering the voting age to 16. Voting needs to be a national holiday in the United States. Like, there's things that are obviously global patterns and lower vote turnouts. And I think a lot of it does have to do with, shrinking choices and other kind of global patterns. But the thing in the United States is, like, how could we even compare? I mean, we put so many barriers to letting people. I mean, I found myself personally, just in the busyness of my life and not having the obligation of a family and all this stuff, it's like, it's hard. You know, like the fact that it's not a national holiday and that people are not just facilitated to vote is the lane of attack we need to have. And Bonora, although I would admit it would be better if there were an unnecessary, it is also needed in every single field of my life. What about a version of Rate My Professor, which focuses on the movie industry, Rate My Director, Producer Director, and the specific ratings from women on the degree of particular abuses? I mean, maybe. I don't know. I there was a great piece, I think, by Kate Press in The Jacobin called Solidarity Being the Only Answer. Like, there does need to basically be, like, union protections and worker solidarity and protection across industries. This is the type of thing, like, that happens when you're not collectively protected and legally protected. I don't know how something like that would work. Ron Reagan, tell the other 509 to tweet me and we'll get lunch. I don't think that's the real one, but we'll see. Twisted Tea Cozy, regarding sponsors, the only life insurance policy I need is a set of Harry's razors. Ooh. Also, isn't the most eco-friendly undies arrangement just to go commando? Well, I guess if you're that rugged, go for it. Umar Shami.
Being naked entirely is probably the best
option. Yeah, being naked is probably the most eco thing you could do. On Friday, Umar Shami, on Friday, Sam talked about a rarefied realm that billionaires live in. A couple of anecdotes regarding that. The new Bugatti Chiron hypercar just went on sale. The entire run of approximately 214 cars have sold out. On average, when the buyers receive their Chiron, it will be the 43rd vehicle in their garage or garages. Yeah.
If you see one of those on the street and you're carrying like a big bag of sugar, just feel free to
Just give a little sprinkle
into the gas.
A little sprinkle into the gas. Just a little. Or a Beverly Hills Cop, maybe a banana in the tailpipe. Maybe.
What does that do? Suppose, I mean, I guess it.
Well, I would watch Beverly Hills Cop.
Okay, I'll find out. It's like Mythbusters.
Like, I think it's like sugar. Nothing too dramatic. Of course, we're not actually advocating that.
No.
I would sort of more frame it as a thought experiment.
Yeah, just do a thought experiment.
Just do a thought experiment.
When you see luxury cars.
Yeah, just do a lot of thought experiments. You're calling from a 518 area code. Who are you? Where are you calling from?
Hello?
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Ah, okay. I'm calling through Fire RTC, so I never really know what area code it is. I'm calling in from Germany. I called in like 2 weeks ago. Jacob is my name.
Hey, Jacob, how are you? Everybody remembers you. Yep.
Yeah. Oh, thanks. Yep. I think you're a bit short on time, so I'll stick to just a little anti-fascist story.
Okay, great.
I really, usually I don't condone violence, but there are occasions, you know? one of these occasions... yes. Is has been told to me by an old comrade. His name is Kurt Goldstein. He was fought in the Spanish Civil War, and he
oh, wow.
he was like one of the original anti-fascists, basically. I had the great fortune of seeing him while he was still alive. And the story goes like this: he was in a socialist pub, and a Nazi came in, and he was also Jewish, and asked, "Do you serve Jewish swine here?" And he didn't say a thing, picked up a 2-pound ashtray of glass and smashed it over the fascist's head and ran out.
Nice.
And so, well, you know, I do not condone it every time, but I think there are, you know, there are occasions.
thank you for the call. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
Have a great day.
Have a nice one.
Please call it and call in. Please call in more. Thank you. All right. Let's get to this last piece of sound. This is Russell Brand talking with Bill Maher on voting strategy in the left. I have a soft spot for Russell Brand. I've always, you know, obviously I disagree with, you know, either not voting or not sucking it up and voting for awful candidates, whether they be, you know, Clinton or Macron, if it means averting a Trump or a Le Pen. But I do think
actual fascism.
Actual fascism, exactly. But I do think that it's, you know, I think that Brand articulates a perspective that is useful to it's going to be an important part of our kind of rhetorical and strategic approach moving forward on the left. And this is here he is talking with Bill Maher.
You have expressed reservations about voting itself. Where are you on voting now?
Well, Bill, I think that the dominant political parties have a real obligation, as Harold was just explaining, to present the voters, by which I mean human beings like me, real vision, real possibilities, and to transcend the idea that they are merely managers of bureaucracies whose role it is to prevent us being, I suppose, bludgeoned by lunatics like the current one. So I feel that what...
But you would agree that it would be better if people had voted for Hillary Clinton, right?
Yes, I wondered if
Come
you would
on,
ask me that.
Come on, please. Well, we're getting along
so good.
Do you
think, like...
If Hillary Clinton would not be pulling out of the Iran deal or the Paris climate deal or...
It's really... You know, I respect you and I admire you very much and I think you are a courageous man. One of the problems I have in instances such as this is that politics became so centralized, realistic opportunities weren't offered to ordinary people. And when a candidate like Bernie Sanders emerged, he was not given the opportunities that he deserved. I never voted in my country.
What do you mean he was not given the opportunities? He was given every opportunity. He ran in America. People voted for him, not as many as Hillary.
I wonder why this occurs. Because I mean, you're talking now about the manipulation of boundaries and borders and the way that certain political figures are managed towards positions of power and authority. That exists at a party political level. The Democratic Party had preferences. Their preference was Hillary. You got Hillary. Hillary lost. I don't think that this is not... I think you can tell from a glance that I'm like not a Donald Trump guy.
I'm trying to come to common ground with you. Let me give you one example from this week. While all the craziness was going on, the Republicans did not reauthorize a program called CHIPS, Children's Health Insurance Program.
Appalling.
Yes, you know of it. Okay, it's been there for 20 years, bipartisan. 9 million kids now are not going to get, you know, what they need, the doctor visits, checkups.
Yes, this is dreadful.
So I think for those people, voting matters.
You are quite right.
It's easy to say, oh, voting and who can, they're all bad. But for those people downstream, it would have mattered if he wasn't president.
I entirely recognize I had a comparable problem in our country because I'd advocated not voting. I said, well, don't vote until they give you realistic opportunities until there are politicians that speak directly to you, that speak for ordinary working people. Until then, why would you participate in this spectacle? You're being invited to participate in something that doesn't offer you realistic opportunities. The candidate for the left at that time was, I would say, a comparable candidate, someone that was a neoliberal, centralist politician that didn't oppose the corporate interests and elite interests. This allowed hegemony to continue. Now, I think that if the left isn't brave enough to occupy the space where ordinary people whose lives are in difficulty and in trouble, if a politician on the left doesn't say, we are interested in representing you, we want to take care of you, ordinary Americans, then the bizarre, lunatic rhetoric of a man like Trump is suddenly appealing. We have witnessed this. The alternative is in the United Kingdom that Jeremy Corbyn, a genuine socialist candidate, has come to the front, and I voted for the first time, and people care
What were you like on cocaine?
That's a decent Bill Maher line. What do you like on cocaine? I think that it's a very important conversation because I think, of course, like in the narrow sense, Bill Maher is right. But the key word is the narrow sense. So what people are going to need to do is synthesize those two positions. And I think, you know, Brands is already getting there. And in fact, if I recall correctly, he didn't, in, you know, he didn't finish the story, but I think he actually did advocate voting for Ed Miliband in 2015.
Yeah, he might not have voted himself, but they had like a YouTube live stream from his kitchen.
Right. He brought He brought Ed Miliband on his YouTube show. So even then he was recognizing that, of course, and this is the perfect balance. The perfect balance that needs to happen is voting can often be an incredibly, I mean, look, I have the opportunity in my city council race coming up here in early November, I'm very excited to vote for Jabari Brisport. He's a Democratic Socialist, a Green, and he has incredible plans on gentrification, on housing affordability, on the environment, on policing. I want him in the city council, and he can be in the city council. That's an affirmative vote. Voting for Bernie Sanders is an affirmative vote. Voting for Jeremy Corbyn is an affirmative vote. But there's also just the obvious that you vote to minimize the damage and you vote to make sure that 9 million kids stay on a fucking health insurance thing. It's grotesque that that's even a question. But then on the other hand, we must not narrow our conversation to that. We need to push the boundaries of what is expected from politics, what politicians offer, and never settle for the type of centralized technocratic mediocrity that Brand is talking about. So I think Russell Brand's actually getting to the right place. And I just wish that somebody could answer the Bill Maher question with, yes, of course, Hillary's better than Trump. What's next? What do you need to do to improve our lot? Do you think it's just sufficient to vote for a minimally better, you know, very better, but pretty awful neoliberal who's not going to do anything fundamental on climate inequality and foreign policy and just avoid fascism, and then you can go just keep minding off while most of this country continues to sort of brutally suffer in the world? Do you think that's good enough, Bill? Answer the obvious and then go on the offense. But as long as you can't answer the obvious, you're not going to look credible. Because if you can't get that Hillary Clinton's better than Donald Trump, I mean, come on. Then that's when we get into just some fucking dumb shit. You're calling from a 651 area code. Who are you? Where are you calling from?
Hey, this is Tiffany Trump. Yes, the Tiffany Trump. Hey, is Bill Maher coloring his hair?
Probably.
Did you notice that? His hair looks weird. He should cut that out. Hey, Donnie Jr. is a dick. Okay, all the kids, dad always loved Donnie Jr. the most, platonically. And my dad and me, we weren't too close, right? Like, we never really dated, more like friends with benefits type of deal. But, like, when we spent time together, it was special. Like,
right.
I thought we had a deeper connection, right? And then so one time, it was like right before I got off heroin, I was on a bridge. My friend had killed herself, so I was on a bridge. I was about to jump into traffic. And I called my dad, and I was looking for help. And he just asked if I was the slutty one. And at that point, I jumped into traffic, and I ended up in a body cast for 6 months. He never called me one single time, but at least I got off the smack, okay? So, anyway, I don't want to hear any whining. Well, I guess Donnie Jr. is an alpha male now, so he's happy about that. But, you know, I'm still the slutty one in Dad's eyes. Hey, did you see that Ben Shapiro tweeted? I tweeted you guys this. Ben Shapiro posted one of the most racist cartoons I've ever seen. Well, it is ridiculous. It seems like something Funny or Die would do. But anyway, it's 47 seconds. So if you got a chance to take a peek at it, I would suggest it. Have a good day, everybody. And fuck you, Donnie Jr. All right, bye.
Bye-bye. You're calling from a 216 area code. Who are you? Where are you calling from?
Hi, this is David calling from Michigan.
Hey, David. Can't hear you too good, man. You're not on speaker, are you?
Hi, this is David calling from Michigan.
Hey, David. How you doing? What's on your mind, man?
Real good. Yeah, I've been having a lot of time to think about, you know, what's gone wrong in the country. I had one thought. I don't know if it's been discussed before, but I feel like the country usually had a purpose to it. And if you think about the beginning of the nation, there was establishing a democracy. Then there was mastering the continent. Then you moved on to sort of shared prosperity coming out of, you know, going from the labor movement into FDR and Truman and all that. And there's anti-communism. And, you know, there's always been something. I'm not sure what it is right now besides possibly the stock market.
I think my candidate for this is, I think it's eventually going to be climate change.
I think it will be. I think also you should check out the interview that I did probably, I don't even remember now, several months ago with Scott Atran. And Scott Atran studies terrorism and sort of group meeting and how it leads to terrorism. There's a lot of overlap with why people be attracted to the alt-right. And yeah, there's no doubt that, you know, life is not, you know, purely a materialistic kind of consumer experience. And if that's all you have to offer people, I do think that there is some lack of a certain sort of sense of collective mission. And that's another problem of neoliberalism.
Yeah.
So I would check out the Scott Atran interview. Thanks so much for the call, man.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. You're calling from a 617 area code. Who are you? Where are you calling from?
Hello.
Hello,
Mikhail. How are you, Tavarish? By the way, what's your dad's name? Humor me really fast. What's your dad's name?
Glenn.
This is first. What?
Glenn.
Arusha Glenevich. Glenevich, how are you? Surviving life in hell, yeah? How much money you pay to receive special lady Trump urination? Oh, okay, sorry. Thanks
what?
For humoring me there.
I totally missed that. Okay.
Hi.
You're calling
it's
from
okay,
Kiev.
It's okay. I was just being silly.
No problem.
Hi, from Ukraine.
Hey,
okay.
What's on
but
your
I'm
mind?
Just, no, I'm just using, yeah, just the patronymics. It's like what you call people their father's first name and then a suffix.
Oh, okay.
It's just what they do. Yeah, so you'll get used to it, don't worry. I guess I put up a link on the Discord about from an article from Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty. First, I'm just curious, do you have any opinions on RFE/RL as a publication? Like, you personally seem to like.
Talking about the Discord on Michael Brooks' show. You're talking about
yes. No, but I'm just curious in general. Do you have any take?
I not strongly, to be honest with you. I don't. I would need to know more. I mean, I've occasionally read. I know that name, but I don't know that much. To be honest with you.
Okay. All right. No worries. Actually, just the article. Side note. Maybe it's a bit obscure about Turkish academics in Kazakhstan, like not being stripped of visa and residency. Just as it's basically they're punishing people there for as it's kind of a proxy war of war between Turkey and Russia, and just kind of it's a main struggle that goes on there. I don't know. Most people just think of Kazakhstan as like Borat and that shit, but it's actually I don't know. It is kind of like a major space of how they operate.
Right. No, it's a big, that's an important.
So maybe something worth checking out. I hope I'm not the only like Central Asian news junkie out there. So
no, I will definitely check it out.
Okay.
Thanks so much. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you.
You're calling from a 226 area code. Who are you? Where are you calling from?
Hey, Michael, how's it going? It's Albert from Vancouver, Canada.
Hey, Albert, what's going on, man?
Hey, I just wanted to touch on the whole like Ben Shapiro libertarian thing, which is like the sort of peak faux intellectualism in the 21st century, I think.
Yeah.
And I think what liberals need to do is focus on their just fundamental misunderstanding of capitalist economics. Like, it's not even worth going into Marxist theory or any of that,
they don't even understand just basic capitalism. They don't know that market equilibrization is a pre-assumption of economics. Markets just don't naturally do that. They don't know that economics assumes perfect competition and perfect knowledge. They have no idea. And when you talk about this, they either just stop the conversation or change it to something else.
But I think here's my thing, Albert. This, and I think it's all useful. I'm just interested, I don't know Ben Shapiro specifically, but I just think that there are a lot of people that are paid to be wrong. Like if you're working at some think tank, as an example, that's funded by the Koch brothers, it doesn't matter if somebody corrects you on market equilibriums or how a market gets set in place. You're being paid to put forward intellectual products to advocate policies that help your donors. And that's why, you know, I'm much more interested mostly in where people get their funding than their ideas. Most people's ideas are pretty boring, but their funding tells you a lot. And I think that, you
know. But then why does.
Yeah, so I think that that's. Sure, just you know,
why does
I think
the media quote them?
Well, but the media is totally, compromised by all this stuff too. I mean, it's not like media consolidation and corporate ownership of media doesn't have an effect on our democracy and even resources to do things like that. But I just think that, you know, I'm not saying that there isn't, of course, there's a room, you know, there's debate and there's, you know, but there's sort of three different tiers to it. And one is, you know, I think there are debates that are on premises and that are really fundamental. There is a conflict between how different people think society should work and why. And those are, in fact, value questions, and they are sort of basic political orientation questions. Then there's another range of debate, which is different. I mean, it's not a debate that I would have with somebody like Ben Shapiro, because there are debates about, you know, we share some of the same goals and sense of the world, but how do you bring about those things in actuality? But I think that there's plenty of people, especially the nature of the modern right, it's either kind of like dumb, you know, YouTube culture war shit, outright neo-Nazism, alt-right stuff, or it's just being a bag man for, you know, a donor class. And in each of those situations, you're not dealing with people who are, you're not, the notion that you can sit and have an Oxford style debate with somebody who's either like covertly committed to fascism or someone whose whole paycheck relies or, you know, following relies on promoting, not again, it's not bad economics, because it's economics that works perfectly for what their policy agenda is. Right? Like we talk about Kansas for practical purposes for normal people. Of course, trickle down is a total failure and catastrophe, and you see it. It's in Kansas. It's obvious. But I don't know why the Koch brothers would view Kansas as a failure. I mean, they're still making money. Probably got some, I think they're located in Kansas. They probably, you know, they got some local tax breaks. They're in Wichita. So great. Why is that a failure for them? They don't care.
But what about these masses that just go along? We got people in Canada that are listening to the crazy people you got in the States and saying that we should take our own free freaking health care away. Like that actually
they're,
happens
well, they're,
in
they're
Canada.
Morons. They're morons. But they've take well, there's first
so
of all,
how
because
do you
there's
change
a,
that?
I think
you have to beat them.
You have to beat them. You have to win. You have to destroy them politically. And realize what you're dealing with. And my guess would be my suspicion in Canada too would be that the point of that spear of attack is not, hey Canadians, let's take away your health care. I would assume it's, you know, hey Canadians, Muslims are coming in and they're going to ruin all that shit. It's all the culture.
Yeah,
wars,
well,
right?
it's all libertarianism is just all is all racism. I'm coming increasingly friggin' convinced of that, you know. Like it's like they all point to Milo, say, oh, this guy was going to a speech to hear a gay man speech who dates black men, and then you hear him and who's Jewish of Jewish descent, and then he's sending all this
look
these,
if your defense anti-Semitic passwords, and I can't believe I have to say this in the 21st century. If your defense of not being racist is that you fuck black people, That is a profoundly racist statement. And it's not like this country doesn't have a history of, I don't know, everybody from fucking slave owners to a monster who didn't even die that long ago, like Strom Thurmond, raping, coercing, or maybe, you know, even having quote-unquote consensual sex with people whose entire lives they were dedicated to destroying, robbing labor from, and snuffing out. To say that as a defense shows at best, massive historical stupidity and illiteracy, and probably just as much and more than likely racism. Thanks for the call, man.
Stop trying to shut down debate, Michael, please. Stop trying to shut down
exactly.
debate.
Exactly. But you see, that's kind of the point, right? Is that we need to have more conversations like this. Like, what's actually going on here? Versus trying to, you know, Milo, actually, if you do an audit of every single college campus in the United States and you include, you know, the Big Ten schools and state schools in the Midwest and, you know, in Christian colleges, that actually you might find there's a lot more conservative professors that you realize. And actually, here's, you know, just as you have some anecdote about Brown, I have another anecdote about Brown about a kid saying something racist, and we can just do anecdotes all day. You think Milo, whose whole media platform and whole funding source from the Mercers was predicated on doing that, and then he's going to go, oh, thank you for this rational, charitable exchange of ideas. I'll revise what I think. That's not the world we're in. It's ridiculous. And the people that keep trying to sell you on that are the unwitting handmaidens of the alt-right. And I'm actually going to be talking about this more on my show tomorrow. Thanks so much for the call, man.
No problem. Just as an anecdote, yeah. Canada, I had a conservative MP as a professor. Never a liberal MP, never an NDP MP, conservative MP as a professor. Thanks a lot. Have a good one.
Thanks, brother. Bye-bye. All right. Last call of the day. I'm sorry I can't get to everyone. You're calling from a 604 area code. Who are you? Where are you calling from?
Hey, Michael. This is Evan, also from Vancouver, BC, funny enough.
Oh, wow. A lot of Canada today. What's going on, man?
Yeah, a lot of well, it's Thanksgiving up here, so happy Thanksgiving to all the Canadians. We don't have work, so
nice.
We're all at home calling you.
Yeah,
yeah. I wanted to call and talk to you a little bit. The last time you were on, or the last time I saw you on, you were talking about the NDP leadership race.
Yeah, well, I was talking about Jagmeet Singh specifically. I didn't get into the race.
Yeah, yeah. You were talking about Jagmeet Singh specifically. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, yeah.
One of the things you said was that he won on a genuine sort of leftist platform, and that was what got him there.
And you're going to say he did not. I've been hearing this from a lot of NDP people.
Well,
yeah,
not that he didn't. I mean, so his platform was certainly to the left of the last NDP federal race.
Uh huh.
But that's always true in the sort of Democratic Social Party leadership race, right?
Right, 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 right.
But like, if you looked at the policy proposals from the four candidates in this leadership race, he probably was the rightmost candidate.
So why do you think he won?
I think he won because he brought in a lot of people. And that was the thing that I wanted to say. He did do something really fantastic,
yeah,
which was he signed up more new members than the other three candidates combined.
Well, there it is. I mean, that was
spectacular ground game.
And that's, you know, to me, like, people ask about like these kind of trade-offs in voting. And like, obviously, my instinct is always to vote for the leftmost candidate. But I got to tell you, if you've reached an acceptable bar of leftism, which my understanding of researching Jagmeet Singh is that he has, right? That's my understanding. If you reach that bar,
I'm to the left of all four of them, but I'm happy with him.
Right, and I'm sure I'm to the left of him too. But I would say that, like, if you've hit your bar and you actually have a position that is real on, you know, say the environment or inequality or what, you know, and then you also get a countervailing thing like, I might be the guy to be the first NDP prime minister. Like, that's pretty compelling because that's the paradox of our time is we need to be super unapologetically and move further and further and further to the left and be really serious. But then at the same time, like, we have to win. You know, like, for 2016, yeah, people were so devastated about Bernie. For 2016, that race he ran was an incredible accomplishment. In 2020, we need to elect a progressive as president. Now, I'm not saying, of course, I'll do the caveat. If it sucks and it turns out badly and it's Trump versus some fucking mediocre third wayer, I'm going to vote for the third wayer. That's voting, whatever. But we need to start electing like Jeremy Corbyn needs to become prime minister of the UK. Someone like Bernie Sanders or Bernie Sanders himself needs to become president. And in Canada, you know, we need a real left, or at the very least, genuinely center-left progressive leader like a Jagmeet Singh. So if he can actually do that, you know, that to me is also, it's a balance, but that's compelling.
And I mean, he does have some good policies. Like he is, you know, advocating putting in two new tax brackets. He's advocating reinstating the estate tax up here.
Yep.
You know, there's good things on his list.
Yeah.
I wanted to mention as well, like his win, this wasn't a small win. Like he won 53% of the vote on the first ballot.
Wow.
In a group of four.
Like, is he bringing in the other three?
Usually go is, what's that?
Is he going to work with the other three? Like, does he have sort of good?
No. So he's already said that he's going to make my choice. You know, the head of something or other. I don't remember what it was, but
okay.
And then one of the other ones he's on as well. Like I think probably all four of them will end up, you know, fairly high party officials.
That's great. Because my understanding in the last election is that NDP moved pretty. I mean, I know Arthur from Winnipeg will not like this, but my understanding is that NDP did move fairly, especially for a genuine social democratic party. They moved pretty far to the right on economic questions.
Well, there was a difference between the party platform and the messaging.
Mm.
So the party platform, you know, Art's right. Like, the party platform was pretty genuinely left.
Shut the fuck up! Sorry.
But the mess, like, every time Tom Mulcair got a microphone put in his face, he was talking about balancing the budget or some shit like this, right?
Very inspiring. Yeah.
And it was like, yeah, I mean, nobody cares. Like, who gives a shit?
Right.
Right, like, and I mean, like, Canada doesn't have that big a debt. It's much smaller, you know, per capita than the States. The deficit wasn't that bad. It was like, you know, I think the deficit was, the numbers were somewhere between 1 and 2 billion deficit.
Right.
Right. It was like some small, nobody cared.
Right. Right.
And yet that was what he wanted to talk about. And it was like, I don't know, just talk about your tax ideas or talk about your housing ideas or like,
talk about actual real things. Talk about actual real things. Exactly. All right, man. I appreciate the call.
Anyway.
Thanks a million.
Yeah, cheers. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
Happy Thanksgiving. All right, a few more IMs, and then we're out of here. Ryan Tennant, Trump. Hey, Puerto Rico, you're really messing up our budget by getting in the way of these hurricanes. Hey, Mike, fly to Indianapolis for 2 seconds. Show everyone how much you hate black people.
By the way, the Jones Act waiver expired, and it doesn't look like they're going to re-waive it. It's
disgusting. Perez teaching at Brown. Wasn't one of the arguments being made to support his candidacy that he'd be able to focus on, entirely on being the head of the DNC, and that would, it sure was. I don't understand that. I'm sorry. Spinster. Just wondered if you can continue the conversation you're having with Cliff on Friday with an academic about the unprecedented wealth of these political donors, their motivation, mindset, and lifestyle. We'll look for possible interviewees. Yes, I would be open to that for sure. Binder Dad, please put the call from Seoul on YouTube ASAP. Great show as always. Left is best. CM Michael Laylist, to celebrate Columbus Day, Philadelphia Inquirer had an editorial about how lily white trade unions are still in the city that is majority minority. Seize the means, but only for white people. As someone in the union, this pissed the hell off of me. That's really weird. Did you see Zaya Gelani's recent piece about Russia got a signal boost by InfoWars? What's up with that? I have no idea. I don't know anything about any part of that. That is weird, though. Christo. Anna Navarro, Amy Siskin, Bill Kristol, and George Will. Yes, I agree. Apparently, there's a Scalite version of La Poupée. Jay Tingle, as I recall, the banana in the tailpipe got a lot of mileage in the Village Voice movie review. and the final IM of the day. Denver Dave, The Atlantic reports that Pence's drama queen stunt cost $100,000 for just the flight to Indianapolis. More if the other transportation and security costs are included. We are back live tomorrow, everybody. Thank you. It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light's shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice was made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you?